And I, again, want to review just general area that we're in. 26, 27, 28, we've got starting with the Lord's Supper and then the betrayal, moving into crucifixion, then resurrection, Great Commission. So we've got end of Jesus' life, the climax of the gospel. This is a big deal. And this morning, we are, as I say, finishing 26, moving into 27. So we'll be talking about the betrayal and the trials of Jesus. I also, since we're finishing 26, left in the general plot structure of what's already happened in 26, so that way we can be reminded. And as one more thing, there was a question that I left it in the question section of last week that spills over into this week. And so I wanted to start, as they say in diving, you start deep and then you move back up. So let's start with this question. It was question 4 last week about the influence of Zechariah on this section. So in Zechariah 11, 12, and 13, we've got several different texts that are influential in Matthew's narrative. He quotes some of them. Some of them are just obvious references. So who wants to summarize for me a few of the events that are happening in Zechariah 11 through 13 that influence our reading here in Matthew 26, 27? That's okay. That was last week's question, so you probably forgot. I kind of forgot, honestly. So I had to go back and look at it. So in chapter 11, Zechariah gets this commission where there's a flock. It is doomed to slaughter, mostly because the flock's terrible and the shepherds are terrible. And so he says, you got to be the shepherd to the flock doomed to slaughter. And so he goes in to be the shepherd, and the flock rejects him, and all the people get mad at him. And he's like, fine, I give up. And so he turns in his commission. He throws in his 30 pieces of silver. He says, look, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. And then the flock gets ended, effectively. But we come back in chapter 13 with this section in 7 through 9, where, again, he is the flock. He's the shepherd, but he is struck. So it says in verse 7 of Zechariah 13, awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, declares the Lord. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. I will turn my hand against the little ones. So get this very interesting and somewhat confusing oracle where God is striking his right-hand man. And you're like, why would he do that? And of course, we get context for that in the New Testament. But Jesus quotes this section, the strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered, back last week's reading. And this is, of course, helpful in understanding that God has had this plan, that Judas' betrayal, the death, as Jesus has been saying all along, this must happen. And here we see, again, another reminder that this must happen. But what is the result is that the sheep are scattered, but that two-thirds are cut off, but one-third is refined and purified, and they are God's people. And again, we've been seeing, just as Jesus is coming to the Jews, they're not very receptive to the gospel. And so Jesus, he tries to be their shepherd, but they reject him. And then we get another view of the Jews, that the shepherd is struck, many are scattered, but a third are refined. And we have a small section of the Jews, and later on of all the people who are actually loyal to God. The last thing is to go back in between these. In chapter 12, we get in verse 10, I will pour out on the house of David, on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and weep bitterly over him as one weeps over a firstborn. Again, we've got references that kind of point back. You think firstborn obviously makes you think of the Exodus and of Israel. But this is clearly pointing forward to Jesus. In fact, in Revelation, Jesus is referred to as him whom they have pierced, I think is where that reference is. And obviously this makes sense in what we know from Matthew. And one more thing, which I didn't put on this worksheet, but I was like, how did I miss that? It's 13:1. On that day, there will be a fountain opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse themselves from sin and uncleanness. And you're like, okay, him whom they have pierced, a fountain opened up for cleansing. This is clearly pointing us toward Jesus. And as I said, several of these passages are clearly referenced. And so this reading this story is should be in the back of our heads as we're reading through chapter 26 and 27, because Matthew is trying to remind us of that. Are there any thoughts or comments on that before we jump into our text? Yeah, okay. Definitely, I mean, all around this in 9, 10, some in the beginning of 12, and especially, as you say, in 14, which we're actually going to reference this morning in our sermon. Yeah, there's a battle imagery of God taking his people and turning them into a force that will sometimes be opposed, but always will bring glory to him in victory of some sort. So yes, that is, in terms of in various inclusios going on. Yes, there's definitely bookending this section all throughout battle imagery, which of course makes you think of kings, which is brings us to kingdom. Kingdom of heaven is at hand, Matthew 26. So that was me turning to Matthew 26. In Matthew 26, verses 47 through 50, we get the actual betrayal. In these four verses, Judas comes up, he gives the sign, he gives Jesus a kiss, and I think verse 50 is fascinating. Jesus says to him, "Friend, do what you came to do." And I think that this is very telling about Jesus. I think there's two things about this that really stand out to me. One, that despite the fact that Judas is literally in the act of betraying him, Jesus still calls him his friend. And I think this speaks volumes to who God is, who Jesus is as God, that he doesn't give up. And even in this moment of the lowest moment of Judas's life, of really anyone's life, Jesus is still holding out hope for Judas, I think, and still feels a connection with him. But what I think is also very interesting is the rest of that. Do what you came to do. And he points this out in the sections that, in the next part of this section, that like Jesus could stop this if he wanted to. He has the power, but he is willing to be betrayed. He says, do what you came to do. And he accepts his fate willingly because, as we've seen leading into this, he was in the garden. He was praying, let this cup pass from me if it's possible. And the cup came nonetheless, or is coming, depending on what the cup exactly is. Jesus is accepting of his fate and of Judas being the bringer of said fate. As we move then into the next part of this larger section, 51 through 56, we get the arrest. And here we see Peter, you know, cuts off the ear of the high priest, and or not the high priest, but cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest. There we go. And Jesus is like, what are you doing, man? And he fixes it, and then Jesus says, this has to happen for the scriptures to be fulfilled. And then he says, guys, you're coming at me like a robber. Like, you've had opportunities to do this before. Why wait till now? Kind of pointing them in the idea, like, you guys, you know that what you're doing is wrong, right? Like, you're aware of this. You wouldn't do this in the day. So A couple things. Let me ask on verse 51. Is that what I want to ask? No, not that one. I want to ask on verse 54. He says, but how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? Hit me with some scriptures that Jesus is referring to here. I've got one in particular that is like the correct answer, but there are lots of right answers, if that makes sense. That's funny. I was going to say 53:12 to be the right one. So it's funny that it says 53:1-11. No. In verse 12, there's several answers, and we can look at them in a second. But this is the one where it says that Jesus will be numbered among the transgressors. And especially in Luke's gospel, but also you can kind of see it here in Matthew, it's kind of obvious that Jesus is being treated like a common criminal. He says, have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Like, they're attacking him like he is some sort of criminal. And, of course, 53, in the larger sense, has Jesus going to bear our sins. He is a lamb to the slaughter, and he is the Lord's servant. And all of these things Jesus has been hinting at. He's been saying, look, this must happen. This is going to happen. And so here Jesus is saying, just once again, look, nothing has changed in the plan. This is still the plan. This had to happen. And he's okay with it, at least somewhat. I want to also point out verses 51 and 53. In verse 51, it says, behold, one of those who were with Jesus took out his hand and struck the sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. But then Jesus, of course, fixes that. And then when we see in verse 53, do you not think that I could appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Maybe this is cheating also because I pulled in a point from Luke. I'll pull in a point from John. John's a big deal is that Jesus was in control the entire time. And when Pilate is talking to Jesus, and he's like, don't you know I have power? And Jesus is like, no, you don't. The only power you have is the power that God gives you. And again, it's a more subtle point here in Matthew, but the same point is clear, that Jesus could stop this if he wanted to. He has not been outsmarted. He's not been outmaneuvered. Jesus is in control the entire time. And also, recognizing that Jesus is king and ruler of a different kind of nation, a different kind of kingdom that doesn't fight with swords and clubs, doesn't fight with physical means, but that our warfare is of a different type, as we've already discussed. I think that's all I wanted to say about this section here. So let me open it up for comments. What more do you guys think we should be bringing out of verses 47 through 56? Yeah.
So at the beginning of this, at least in 47, we can see that there's a lot of additional support for what's going on. Right? So the crowd didn't just get into it once Jesus is kind of in front of them, the top of the hill. They're already into it here. And somehow they're getting convinced that they need to go after Jesus with the chief priest and the elders.
Yeah. It just occurred to me for the very first time how weird it is that these are the people that are tracking down Jesus. Like, you would think that if you were going to go fight somebody and capture them, that you would get, like, an army. But we get chief priests and elders, which don't seem to me like the best candidates for this. But, of course, they're the ones that have a vendetta with Jesus. Yeah, and it's funny how quickly our allegiances can change. Greg and then Eric.
Well,
We'll get you, and then we'll get back to Eric. Yeah. It's astonishing how frequently Jesus tells them, like, I'm going to die. This must happen. And it takes them seeing it for it to really click. Oh, man. Let's get you first. Right.
Christ.
All right, Levi, and then we've got to move on. Luke. So, moving in through this, we get Jesus before Caiaphas. Big main points here. They found some false witnesses against him, which I just love. I don't know if they were like, hello, we need false witnesses, or whether they were like, hey, we're trying to condemn this Jesus guy, and they just happened to be getting false witnesses. But either way, they accuse him of of made up charges, effectively. Like, Jesus does say that he's going to destroy this temple and rebuild it in 3 days, but that's not what he means. And also, that is not recorded in Matthew, which I don't know what that means for us, but I just thought that was interesting. It's in a different gospel, but Jesus gets accused of charges in Matthew that are not present in his book. But anyway, so they get false witnesses against him. That's the big part. The other thing is that they come before him, and he says in verse 63, Jesus was silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said to him, you have said so, but I tell you from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his robes, and he said, he has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is the judgment? And they answered, he deserves death. So, there's a lot to take in here, more than we have time to explain. But effectively, he asks if Jesus is the Christ, and I have a question on here about that. So let's take a minute or two to ask that. What does he mean when he asks, "Are you the Christ?" I'm going to disagree with you. do we have an understanding for the Jewish expectation at this time for the Christ, the Messiah? Yes. And what was the one going to do?
He's going to be the savior, like another king, like David.
Yeah. He's going to win. He's going to fight all the bad guys. They're going to overthrow the Romans. He's going to be the leader. He's, you know, God's anointed one. to bring about the glorification of Israel, which of course Jesus was, but not at all in the way they were expecting. That Jesus is glorifying a spiritual Israel in a spiritual kingdom. And so I think when he asks, are you the Christ, his expectation is, you know, are you the new David come to lead us? And of course, I think as to some extent, I agree with you, Reed, that like, I don't think he believed any of this stuff about Jesus. But I think that his question is not intended to make Jesus blaspheme, but intended to be like, hey, are you really this powerful military leader? And Jesus is like, yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, I am the Christ, but not like you're expecting. And I am the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power coming on the clouds of heaven, which, as we've said, is a reference to Daniel chapter 7. Great. Where Jesus, where we get the image of the Son of Man coming before the throne of God, and he's given the power and the glory of the eternal kingdom. It's a big deal. So Jesus, as he's always been pointing to this, says again, this is me. And that is, I mean, if Jesus was not that, that would clearly be blasphemy. And death is the punishment for blasphemy. So, I mean, there is at least that I can say for the people. But clearly they have mishandled Jesus in a dramatic way. They've misunderstood his teaching. They're on the wrong side of this, and they are not interested in listening. As Eric was saying, like, if you're in the garden and you're trying to attack somebody and they start healing people on your side, like, that should stop you for a second. And as Jesus is saying, like, you guys have had ample opportunity to arrest me. If you thought I was doing something wrong, you could have come at any other time, but you chose right now in the middle of the night because you know that what you're doing is wrong. And they knew what they were doing was wrong, and they knew that they couldn't get Jesus on legitimate charges, think Daniel again, but they were going to accuse him of whatever they could. So that's what they got him on, and that's the Caiaphas thing. Then we get, with the rest of the chapter, 69 through 75, Peter's denial. Three times people are like, hey, you're with Jesus. And he's like, no way. And then the rooster crows, just as Jesus said that it would, back in 34. So, and Jesus and Peter hears the rooster, and he's like, oh man, I done did it. And then he goes out and weeps bitterly. We've kind of already talked about Peter's denial, but did y'all want to say more about Peter's denial or the Caiaphas trial? Yes, Reed. Okay, you go ahead. Yes. Yes. Yes, good point. Right. Yeah, this is not in any way a legal trial. Reed, what were you going to say?
Well, just that all the interactions that the priests and the scribes had with him over the last 3 years, and each time they're coming with a certain condescension, it seems to me. And
yeah.
And so there's this frustration, I think, that is necessary to build up. But then also the priests are having to obey Rome and keep peace.
Yes, I think that's very insightful. And there are some things in that I would like to unpack, but we're going to keep moving. But yes, to all of that. All right, 27. The first two verses I just labeled as transition. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death, and they bound him and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate, the governor. We get some connection here with the first two verses of 26, where they were like, all right, it's time to plot to kill Jesus. And here again, they take counsel to put him to death. And they bring him to Pilate. And so we'll talk about Pilate, but first we have a moment to talk about Judas. And really, this probably should have been two different sections. But anyway, they lead into each other. So Judas, in verses 3 through 5? 3 through... yeah, 5. Then Judas, the betrayer, saw Jesus was condemned. He changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? See to it yourself." And throwing down the pieces of silver into the court, he departed, and he went, and he hanged himself. This is, a lot happens in these, what is this, three verses? Yeah. So, Judas has a change of heart. For some unknown reason, he changes his mind. And he says, "Listen, I did wrong. Take this money back. I don't want it." And they say, "Yeah, no. That, it doesn't work that way, Judas." And so he gets mad, he throws it on the ground, and he runs away, and he hangs himself. As we've noted this, 30 pieces of silver idea has already been presented. Here we see it again. And, of course, when you think back to Zechariah, of him like throwing down the 30 pieces of silver again, the connection is pretty obvious that this storyline is going on. But Judas is not the shepherd. Of course, Jesus is, but the same sort of events point to this. But Judas changes his mind. And I think I think we got to give him credit for that. At least at some point, he recognized that what he had done was wrong. I have heard different theories about this, and one I will present to you because I think it's interesting, and I have no backing for it, but I think it makes sense. And that is, some people have said that Judas never intended for Jesus to be actually captured. That so far throughout the Bible, we've seen Jesus evading capture on many occasions. Specifically, you think about, like in it's either Luke or John at the beginning. I think it's in Luke, yeah. When the people are gathering around Jesus, and he basically, I don't know if he makes himself like invisible or disguises himself, but he like, they're about to throw him off a cliff, and he just like walks right through the crowd. Like, Jesus is a master escape artist. And so Judas has seen time and time again that, like, if Jesus is surrounded by people, he can just get out and that it won't be a problem. And so Judas, we know he has a money problem. And it's possible that maybe he wanted 30 pieces of silver, which is not a lot of money. Or it's possible that maybe he'd been skimming off the top of the treasury so much that now when Jesus says, "Hey, you got the money, go buy the stuff for the Passover," he's like, "I'm a little bit short. How do I make this up?" And so, for whatever reason, he gets the money to betray Jesus, never intending for this to actually happen. And then when it does, he becomes very sad. Now, I think that's probably best case scenario for Judas. I think it's also entirely possible that he just didn't like Jesus, or he was caught up with the scoundrels and the chief priests. But for whatever reason, at this point, Judas recognizes he's done something wrong. He has gone too far, and he can no longer live with the money or live with himself, and so he ends it, which is a very sad ending for Judas. But then, we're still in this point. But then they take the money. This is in verse 6. The chief priest taking the piece of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put it into the treasury since it is blood money." And I don't know what that means. But verse 7. Then they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, saying, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him on whom a price had been set by some of the sons of Israel. And they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me." So they take the money and they buy a potter's field. This potter's field shows up again in Acts 1, which is pretty interesting. But this quotation is a little bit of a mess in a good and interesting sort of way. Let me see how much time I have to really go into this. Yes. Okay. So, effectively, this is a prophecy, this is a quotation from Zechariah that is attributed to Jeremiah, And there are two passages in Jeremiah, Jeremiah 19, where Jeremiah is in a potter's field, and Jeremiah 32, where Jeremiah buys a field. But no part of this is a direct reference to the story of Jeremiah or any passage in Jeremiah. And so, effectively, what we have here is a reference to Zechariah that is said to be a reference to Jeremiah. And the reason for this is twofold. So, one, if you look into the references, and Matthew, this isn't the only time he does this. He has good reasons for doing this. He's not trying to pull the wool over on us. Like in the last verse of chapter 2, he says, Jesus will be called a Nazarene. Yes. I was like, Nazarite? Nazarene. And that's not a direct quotation from anywhere, but it's an amalgamation of prophecies from the Old Testament that Jesus will be rejected, that Jesus will be a nobody, that they'll look on him and scoff at him. Nazarene idea. So here, the reference to Jeremiah, to the potter's field of that Jerusalem is effectively, it's over for Jerusalem, that they're just a bunch of broken pottery. And in chapter 32, where Jeremiah buys a field in the middle of a siege, and Jeremiah is like, why would I buy a field in the middle of a siege? Like, we're going to get taken into captivity. And effectively, God says, it's not over. You will come back. There will be a restoration. And so we get these ideas kind of pulled in here, the buying of the field and the potter's field from Jeremiah to remind us that there is judgment, but it's not over for Jerusalem. And we get this larger quotation from Zechariah because we've already been looking at Zechariah throughout. Here it shows up again. But Jeremiah forms a larger connection throughout the book. The very first time this prophecy formula is used, then it was fulfilled what had been spoken by the prophet, fill in the blank. That prophet is Jeremiah. It's in, I think, 2:17 or something like that. And so here again, this is the last time that prophetic formula will be used, and it serves as a bookend for the book of Matthew. And that is intentional because Jeremiah is, I mean, if you've read the, people used to ask me, they'd say, Brent, do you really want to be a preacher? And I say, listen, I understand it's going to be hard. I've read Jeremiah. And then I read Jeremiah again, and I was like, man, this Jeremiah has a hard time. And he is rejected in many ways. He gets thrown down into a cistern. Like, it's a hard time to be Jeremiah. And I think that is intentional, that Jesus, of course, is a new Moses, but he is in many ways also a new Jeremiah. And he is rejected like Jeremiah, but he brings a message of hope and a new covenant in the same way that Jeremiah does. And I think that's why it says Jeremiah here. because there is some reference to Jeremiah, but it's also a reference to Zechariah. And there's a lot to that. Yeah. So, I got 5 minutes. Excellent. So, Jesus goes before Pilate. He says, hey, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says, you have said so. Again, I will point out that you have said so is what he says before Caiaphas. It's also what he says in 25 when Judas says, this is 26:25. Judas, who would betray him, answered, is it I, Rabbi? He said, you have said so. Jesus doesn't seem to give straight answers. He's just like, yep, that's what you say. And here again, this is the case. Also, fun fact, I believe this to be, and I don't have time to go into this, but in 1 Timothy 6, 12 through 16, Paul talks about the good confession made before many witnesses. It was the same good confession that Jesus made before Pilate. And if you look in all of the Gospels that were extant at the time of 1 Timothy's writing, you will see Jesus only says one thing before Pilate, which is that you have said so. So Jesus claiming to be king of the Jews is, I believe, the good confession, a better good confession than, say, Jesus is the Son of God, because it means more. And I think that's what Paul would have said as well. Moving on from there, we get the crowd chooses Barabbas over Jesus. Again, Jesus treated like a common criminal chosen over Jesus. And so even more, we're driving the nail into these people's treatment of Jesus, and they're just, they want him dead. And at whatever cost it's going to be, they're like, sure, release an insurrectionist. We don't care, but we want Jesus. And in verse 19, we get an interesting section. He says, besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, this is Pilate, his wife sent word to him, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him in a dream. And again, we see in 24, when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. So Pilate recognizes that Jesus is innocent. His wife has told him he is... He feels like Jesus is being wrongfully convicted here, but he's like, there's nothing I can do. He washes his hands of the matter, and the people say, his blood be on us and on our children, which I think is kind of a reference back to in chapter 23 when Jesus is giving his woes to the people. He says, woe to you because you have the blood, like the shedding of the blood of the prophets of your parents. And you're like, we would never do that. He's like, yeah, no, you would, you do. And here again, he says, the blood be on our children. And so they scourged him and they delivered him to be crucified, which sets us up nicely for next week. I got like 1 minute. Yeah. Two. Awesome. So I asked question two, which I had allotted 10 minutes for, but we don't have 10 minutes. So let me just, of these five people, the five types of people in here, what, thank you, which of these do you want to talk about? Let's get, or just tell us a modern example of one of these types of people that you've got that you think is important for us to remember and take with us as we leave so that we don't repeat this same failing. Any of the five, free game.
Well, what he said to Peter was, fear can make us cowards.
Yes.
So there he said, don't say, I would never do that, because until it happens to you or your family, it's hard to say what you're going to do.
Yes. Yes, and it's easy to overestimate our strength. You had one, Sue? Yes. 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 I've heard that before, but it preaches and it's true. I like the idea of Caiaphas and also the people. So that's kind of B and E. Like, there are just some people that they don't want to follow God. They're going to invent reasons to do it. They will find false prophets. Or they are just going to plow through whatever arguments you say because they want what they want. They don't want to listen to Jesus. They're tired of his teachings. And that's frustrating in many ways, but it's also helpful because you get like in 1 Samuel 8, like God says, listen, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. Like you didn't do anything wrong. And when you look at Jesus, like sometimes we can be discouraged about our evangelistic efforts and we're like, it's not working. What can I do better? It's like Jesus is the perfect teacher, and like 90% of the people rejected him, didn't want to listen to his message. And I think that that's important for us to recognize, A, not to be those kinds of people, but two, that those kinds of people are out there, and that we need to be aware of that as we're teaching the gospel. The next lesson, I don't have a worksheet for it, but it's just the end of chapter 27. So y'all get ready for that, and thank you for class.